The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The people who do this on the street in Moscow, like I said, are under a tremendous pressure, followed all the time, you know, everything they do monitored, so that, you know, the way we can finally get away to handle a case is quite intensive and difficult. It's made far more difficult by the fact that we've had two big rounds of expulsions where we've kicked out Russian diplomats. They've kicked out American diplomats, so that in an embassy that had whatever numbers that they had, were thrown out. The Russians clearly tried to throw out everybody who they thought was CIA there. So my guess would be that there's quite a small group of people able to go out on the street and do these things, which would perhaps, of our own volition, we would say, listen, we're going to put some of our sources on hold here because we can't handle the full volume of them based on the fact that we just don't have the support and resources we need to do that.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 1st, 2018. The New York Times reports that CIA human sources in Moscow are drying up. The newspaper speculates that this may be because of the political environment in the United States, an environment in which the president tweets about the intelligence community and the Steele dossier, and the House Intelligence Committee goes after human sources and outs them. John Cipher knows something about human sources in Moscow. He was stationed there for the CIA in the 1990s. And had to deal with sources. He joined me in the Jungle Studio to talk about the fragility of those operations, the plausibility of the New York Times story, and what we could do to tamp down negative impacts on intelligence collection. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 343, John Cipher on Human Sources in Moscow. John, let's start with a little bit of an overview of your career and why you're the person we're talking to about this particular New York Times story. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. Again, my name is John Cipher. I spent about 28 years in the CIA in the clandestine service. So in the CIA, there's sort of separate tribes, the analytical tribe that does the writing, all source intelligence to the policymakers. And then there's people who tend to work overseas for 2 to 4 to 5 year stints in different places. And so that was my career overseas in Asia and in Russia and in Europe and Balkans and other kind of places. And I did a stint in Moscow. And then later on from Washington was a deputy of our group that ran the worldwide Russia program. And even inside those sort of tribes inside CIA, there's people that focus on counterintelligence, Russia things. There's sort of a China hand group. There's a Middle Eastern, you know, group that goes to Afghanistan and stuff. So I was sort of the Russia tribe, if you will, and retired in 2014 and really didn't have much access or talk to journalists or much writing. But when this Christopher Steele information came out, the dossier, it was sort of a shock to a lot of people and seemed quite strange. But to those of us who lived in Russia and have done battle with what we still call the KGB, it seems certainly plausible. At least the things that they said that the Russians were up to fit exactly with our experience. And so from that period, I started talking about it and writing about it and some other kinds of things.
All right. So talk to us about your, since the story we're going to talk about is a story about a supposed drying up of sources in Moscow. Talk to us about your experience in Moscow. When were you there? How long were you there? And what kind of, you know, without asking you to get into anything you're not allowed to talk about, how intimate is your experience with source development and maintenance in Moscow specifically?
Certainly. So the one thing to remember is the CIA collects information overseas. So the spy side of the agency that recruits and runs, we call assets or agents that provide, you know, secrets to the United States for policymakers. Russia is a little bit unusual for us. Then it's considered a hostile environment. So the fact the Russian counterintelligence services.
And has that always been true? I mean, even in the period in which we looked into Putin's soul, eyes and saw his soul and had a reset and Boris Yeltsin, during what periods of time have we regarded Russia as a hostile environment?
Yeah, it's interesting to those of us who've worked on Russia for a long time to see the vagaries and changes at the policy level about whether they're our friends or reset or whatever. Whereas in fact, on the ground, the way the Russians have treated us and the way the Russians have considered us the enemy has never changed. So those of us that run spy cases in Moscow, it has been exactly the same since Stalin all the way up through the 90s, even in the Yeltsin period. We, you know, to give a sense, if you're a CIA case officer, as we call ourselves, going to Moscow, you have to go through a separate psychological test because essentially you're going to have your house bugged, video in your house. You're going to be followed everywhere you go. You have to know that your life is a completely open book to the Russian services. They're going to, if you're on a date, they're going to be watching it. If you're going to the bathroom, they're going to be watching it. Everyone you talk to will be questioned. They will be trying to play games to put you in compromising situations, all these type of things. So, and then in addition to that, there's language training, cultural training, training to understand what the services have been up to for us over time. Because for them, we are the main enemy. They put incredible focus on what especially the CIA is doing and the United States is doing in Moscow. So unlike other places where the job of a CIA case officer overseas is to go out, find sources, look for people, develop relationships, look for their access and see if you can recruit new sources. Essentially, we can't recruit sources in Moscow because we're under surveillance 24/7, and that's not hyperbole. Like truly, if you wake up at 3 a.m. and walk out, all the guys are there on you and the video is in your house. So it's a different kind of place, even within CIA. So most of the sources, these, I'm talking about human sources, again, we collect against Russia in a variety of ways, but are met and recruited outside the country, maybe if they're in the United States that they're serving or in other places. And then a really small subset of those people that might work for the United States for a variety of reasons, ego, money, problems, whatever it might be. A very small subset of those people have the kind of unique access, the unique kind of personality, ability to protect themselves, to follow directions, to actually be met in Moscow. So even among Russian sources that work for our intelligence services, very, very tiny amount of them will be handled inside Moscow because the way that we do that is so restricted.
So what does the Moscow CIA station do other than get followed?
Well, we do handle cases there. So we meet this small subset of sources, and they have to fit, you know, pretty strict criteria. They have to have information that we can't get any other way that's of critical importance. They have to be the kind of people that are so careful and so willing to follow directions that they will do exactly what we tell them to do, because we will go through incredible machinations to what we call get black, to get free of surveillance, to make one of these meetings. And we might not be able to. We might have gone out and done a variety of things to get ourselves to meet someone, and that person may be meeting and waiting for us in some dark alley. And when we don't show up, he has to know without contacting us in any way, any electronic way, anything, what is the communication plan? If I don't see this, I wait 3 minutes, and if he's not there, I come 2 months later at a different place. And so it's very sort of esoteric espionage spy kind of stuff. But, you know, we are able to handle agents and meet people in Moscow. It's just, it isn't efficient. It's effective because we, you know, when we have the right source in the right place, it's incredibly important, but it isn't like you can turn a switch and get the information that you want.
So when were you there and what were your functions while you were there?
So I was there in the mid-90s, still a fairly young officer. And so I was involved in going on the street, deep knowledge of the city, deep knowledge of the services and how they tracked us. Tried to get, you know, sort of a wide variety of places so I understood the city such that if I had to handle a case, I could go through the process of making sure that we were black, that we were free of surveillance to make that short meeting to get that information that we needed from a source. And so I was what we call just a case officer, a street case officer at the time. And then as I moved up through my career, I became more senior and ran stations and those type of things. But at that time, I was sort of an on-the-street officer, you might say.
All right. So the New York Times reported, I guess, last week that U.S. human sources in Moscow had basically dried up, and they speculated or reported speculation that the dry up is a function of domestic politics, specifically the president's comments and tirades on the subject of the deep state and the Steele dossier and that stuff, and as well congressional focus on these matters up to and including outing human sources, and talked specifically about Devin Nunes' role. So as a preliminary matter, I'm just interested in your reaction to the story, to what extent it seems plausible to you, to what extent it seems implausible. How do you react to the story?
So it does quote me, but I have to say I'm a little skeptical of the full assumption that sources have dried up. It's certainly plausible, and the things that you mentioned are good reasons why sources might go to ground, or we might put a hiatus on meeting people there. The very sort of high-level focus on Russia, if you're in the espionage business, you don't want to be on the front pages every day. You don't want the president and political people talking about things. It just creates extra pressure and extra concern. And the things that we've seen domestically with, you know, Devin Nunes and the House committee, you know, outing sources or suggesting that the FBI and others are corrupt and suggesting that they might uncover more sources. This kind of stuff has a chilling effect if you're the guy at the far end who is the actual person that's providing this information. And the only thing we really truly can provide to our sources is that we'll do everything we can to keep them safe. So the reason I say I'm a little bit skeptical is that the people who are involved who really know what's happening on the streets in Moscow is a very small circle of people. Even within the agency, it's quite compartmented and secret. So I have a sense that the people who really know they don't tend to talk to journalists or sources. And you know how Washington, you know, there's that old saying from Scotty Reston or whatever that, you know, Washington is the ship of state that leaks from the top, right? And so we tend to see stories, I think, in the press about intelligence that come further up the chain, people who receive briefings or people who see intelligence and makes assumptions about why we might be seeing more intelligence or less intelligence. So it's plausible that people are seeing less intelligence about Russia and then make the assumption that that means our sources have gone dry. It's possible, but I don't know that it's true.
But isn't it also perfectly plausible that that small group, and actually before we go into this, let's talk about how segmented and compartmentalized this material really is. So the group of people who actually handle sources mm-hmm. obviously know who those sources are. Who else at the CIA would know source identities, numbers, vitality? And at what point does it become intentionally obfuscated even within the agency right. by way of source protection?
Right. So you hit on exactly sort of how it works. So later in my career, I was deputy of our worldwide Russia program. So in the lead up to 9/11 and afterwards, I was working on Russia program. So we had a large group that was supporting and providing information to people around the world, whether it be Japan, India, South America, trying to deal with Russian cases and that type of thing. But even within the small group at the headquarters that was dealing with Russia things, we still had a compartmented, separated people who dealt with the sensitive cases and the sensitive cases in Moscow. And they were walled off from, and even the official traffic was in a different thing, so you couldn't even read it. If you worked in Russia House, you couldn't read the sensitive stuff for what was happening in Moscow. And then the intelligence that derives from those sources is handled a variety of ways. Regular intelligence, the sources is obfuscated in some way so that you can make it look like it might be coming from somewhere different or written in a way so it's not clear who that source would be. And then even the most sensitive stuff is limited to only specific people. So there might be some intelligence literally that goes to two or three the president and a couple other people. So there's a extensive and long-held process to protect sources all the way up through the chain, even within the CIA.
So you said one possibility is that this is people up the chain making assumptions based on getting less intelligence. But isn't it also possible that it's people up the chain who, having gotten less intelligence, said to the people lower down the chain, why is all this stuff drying up? And people say, we don't know, everything's drying up. And so it's a little bit more than an inference. It is coming from up the chain, which I'm certain you're right about, but it's not necessarily inferential. It is reporting a reality that itself has been reported up the chain.
Certainly possible. And there's another thing that I didn't mention that could impact this. So the people who do this on the street in Moscow, like I said, are under a tremendous pressure, followed all the time, you know, everything they do monitored, so that, you know, the way we can finally get away to handle a case is quite intensive and difficult. It's made far more difficult by the fact that we've had two big rounds of expulsions where we've kicked out Russian diplomats. They've kicked out American diplomats, so that in an embassy that had, you know, whatever numbers that they had were thrown out, the Russians clearly tried to throw out everybody who they thought was CIA there. So my guess would be that there's quite a small group of people able to go out on the street and do these things, which would perhaps, of our own volition, we would say, listen, we're going to put some of our sources on hold here because we can't handle the full volume of them based on the fact that we just don't have the support and resources we need to do that.
One other possibility is that this is partly a function of the 2017 intelligence community assessment, right? I mean, we laid out a lot of information in that, and if I were the Russians, I would have spent a lot of quality time with that document trying to figure out what they can learn about who may be talking. To what extent do you think that could be a factor here?
That is probably definitely a factor. Again, the fact that there's such heightened interest in this, and there's so much information that, you know, by the nature of this having to come out, and even through Mr. Mueller's, you know, indictments, there's information that's come out that shows the Russian intelligence services and Mr. Putin that we have quite a bit of knowledge and information, and they can make assumptions on that. So at the very least, you would think the Kremlin would say, what the hell, guys? You're not doing enough to stop the Americans. You need to double your game here. So it could be coming from either side. The Americans could have less ability to handle people there, and the Russians may have, you know, put extra resources onto the field. And the one thing to remember here, like I said, when we do these kind of expulsions, I don't think people pay attention to it because it's not part of their world. But, you know, there's only so many people in the CIA, in the government, who have Russian language, the training, that can get through the psychological, you know, profiles of having people watch your intimate life, to understand the Russian services, that can write, that have cultural understanding, that have spatial awareness, that can do surveillance detection. You know, even inside, there's people who are bound for a place like Russia who then fail one of the courses or fail the psychological testing or don't learn language well enough. And so when you kick out a bunch of those people, it isn't as if you have a large group of people you can just throw back into the field.
Okay, so to summarize here, it sounds like you are skeptical of the premise, i.e. you're not convinced that the effect being described in that New York Times story is really happening. And to the extent that it is really happening, you're not sure to what extent to attribute it to the antics of the president or Devin Nunes, as opposed to the IAC, the expulsions of personnel, or just the kind of more intense focus on U.S. operations as a result of fallout from the Russian election interference more generally. Is that fair?
I think it's fair, but I also don't want to diminish the fact of the craziness from the president and the House and these types of things. It by no means helps our ability to recruit new sources, to handle sources. The one thing that CIA officers have, that American intelligence officers have, is they travel the world and look for new sources, is they represent the United States of America. They're in corrupt countries where people, you know, are frustrated by their system, and they look at the America as something special that can protect them. when America becomes less special and America looks like a corrupt country and America looks like it's willing to out its sources for political reasons, that by no means helps someone who's willing to risk their life to work for us. So I don't want to suggest that it's impossible that those things are having an effect on handling sources. I just know from a career and intelligence that oftentimes when I would read stories that because everyone's focused on high, that would where we'd make assumptions where there's all sorts of bureaucratic and operational and personnel reasons why certain things happen in a government. So it's absolutely plausible and logical that these things can be having an effect, and they probably do. I just am skeptical that the article is correct in and of itself.
Okay, so let's speak hypothetically about this. If this effect were true, were real, and it were in fact attributable in whole or in part to the antics of the president or Devin Nunes or both or Jim Jordan or Mark Meadows, how would you know? What would that look like? And is there a telltale here, or is this a situation in which you never actually get to draw the connective tissue with what you guys call high confidence? And the most that you can do really is say, well, if this happens, if congressional committees devote themselves to burning human sources, you would expect sources to dry up. They did. The sources dried up, you know, therefore, you know, expected outcome matches actual outcome, but that's all you can ever do.
I think that's probably the right way to put it. That's why, you know, for example, after having a career in intelligence and in a place where it's not comfortable to talk to the public, some of us, General Hayden, Mike Morrell, McLaughlin, a number of other people are talking because I think we see, and as you see, that this sort of shredding of norms and attacks on institutions has the effect of having a long-term damage down the road on these kind of things. Whereas the people in the field, lower level people who are handling these kind of things, they don't see the immediate effect necessarily, nor can they make that direct connection. Whereas it is possible to understand that over time, that shredding, that outing of sources, that taking intelligence services seriously. You know, if I'm a foreign person thinking about working with the United States and I hear a president of the United States daily bashing the FBI and the CIA, I'm going to be like, why am I going to put my trust and faith in this organization? So I think what you describe is certainly likely. I would bet that people inside don't have the full ability to say this is exactly what the problem is, but there's no doubt over time that makes it harder to do our job.
So let me throw out an analogy and see if you find it compelling. Not sure if I do. You know, in the climate change arena, people always say, okay, a particular extreme weather event cannot be attributed to climate change, but climate change makes that category of extreme weather event more likely. Is that a fair characterization of this? You look at this effect, if it's real, and you say, we cannot attribute it specifically, but it is exactly the sort of thing you would expect to see more of in an environment in which this sort of activity is taking place.
I think that's exactly right. I think what's hard to make the direct connection is the data set is too small. I mean, if you have a small set of agents that are in specific places, if you're involved in that case, you know how difficult and fragile it is to get someone in a place that can provide intelligence that you can't get any other way. And if that person goes away, there is no guarantee that the United States will ever find the ability to find a person who's in that specific spot. You could work for years and years trying to meet people. People don't want to spy. You can't get access to them. There's a million reasons why if we have a source in one place and it's the greatest source ever, if that person goes away, we may never have that intelligence again. So I want to make it clear it's really hard to do this kind of stuff, and it's really fragile. And when you lose someone, you can wonder why it might have happened. Sometimes you know for sure there might be a mole somewhere or what have you. So I think what you're saying is exactly right. I think the data set is too small to make direct comparisons, but there's no doubt over time this environment hurts the ability for a case officer on the street to convince someone to risk his life on behalf of the United States.
Before we go on, I want to take the opportunity of having you here to just ask you, you know, for listeners who want to learn about the craft of intelligence gathering, I have my list of, you know, sort of nonfiction that I think is really, really compelling accounts of what the actual task of being a case officer in Moscow looks like. What are yours? Like when you look at what's been written in public that you would recommend that somebody listening to this go to and say, okay, if you want to understand the fragility that you're describing, the kind of exquisite operational nuance and care that is required to make these operations successful, what should people read?
Probably the best one is a couple of years back, I think the agency even cooperated with the author in a book called The Billion Dollar Spy, I think by David Hoffman. I think that's the name of the author.
It's a brilliant
book. About the Tolkachev case, which was in the late 80s. He was a Soviet and a Russian scientist on, I think, anti-aircraft radars, you know, and he decided he was essentially in the secret world of Moscow, but became almost a dissident in his mind and decided that he was going to do everything he could to bring down the Soviet system and help the United States. And the book describes how hard it was in that environment to actually even make contact with someone who could help him get contact with U.S. intelligence, and then how hard it was to manage that process and manage that. Because at the end of the day, it's about trust and relationships. And if you can only meet someone for a couple minutes every 6 months, you know, that communication, that relationship is a hard thing to manage. And so I think that's an excellent book to describe what you said. A couple other books.
Before you go on, I was thinking of that book when I asked the question. I actually reviewed that book on Lawfare in after the Snowden matter. But I want to flag for listeners, what happened to Tolkachev?
Well, unfortunately, we did have spies within our own midst, Alder James and then Robert Hansen at the FBI. It's a more complicated case, but we were able to provide information to the Russians so that they realized they had a problem. And he was eventually caught and arrested and executed. And in fact, it was very interesting. As he was handled, he knew the risk because he was taking. And he asked the United States, asked the CIA as he was meeting with, that he wanted a suicide pill to keep with him because he realized that any day his boss could call him into his office and he could be arrested. So there was a period of time where he was under such pressure that if his boss just called him into his office, he would take out the suicide pill, put it in his mouth between his gums and cheek, go to see his boss. And if his boss had some random thing, it wasn't big, he'd walk back out, take the pill back out. But he was ready at any minute to commit suicide and kill himself because he understood how that system worked. But unfortunately, he was caught and killed, yeah.
Anyway, you were saying some older literature.
Well, there's a couple of other books that aren't necessarily about Moscow, but they're about sort of Russian espionage. You know, there's one on the Penkovsky case called The Spy Who Saved the World, which also has a lot of information about how a case is run. And there's another one called by William Hood called Mole, about an early Soviet case, GRU officer called Popov in Vienna that was spying for the Americans. Those are the ones that come immediately to mind.
I'm interested. We had a really interesting debate on the Lawfare podcast earlier this week between Jack Goldsmith and David Chris, debate, discussion, about the tone and substance of some of the intelligence community leadership, Brennan in particular, who's spoken out, and, you know, whether and how IC leadership should be speaking out about the president, about the environment. I'm interested for your thoughts on it. You know, when the president is doing the things that he's doing, when Devin Nunes is doing the things that he's doing, what should the Mike Haydens and John Brennans and John McLaughlins and Mike Morrells and have to say about it? And what is the message that is being communicated to, you know, by the leadership, to the former leadership, to the current staff, the current workforce?
I mean, the culture inside CIA is one of just don't talk. Keep it quiet. We have a mission to do. We're around the world. We're doing it every day. Anything that spins up this issue that puts former intelligence officers sort of on the pedestal that the president can focus on, they look at it as a bad thing in general. It's just a cultural. Many of them also realize that many of us have a unique ability to do that now and play an important role. So like anywhere else, there's a mixture of opinion probably within the intelligence community about about the value of these things. Far be it from me to try to tell any of these senior people, Mr. Brennan or Mr. McLaughlin or Mr. Hayden or anybody, to what they should be saying and not saying. And I follow them closely. And I think for the most part, I agree with almost everything they've said. And I think they're playing a really important role. I think Mr. Brennan is a little bit different in the sense that, you know, the one thing that Donald Trump really does well and really understands well is just sort of the feral nature of, you know, attack politics. And I think he has realized that Brennan is a really good enemy for him to, a straw man for him to put up to attack. You know, he's not necessarily, he doesn't come across as an incredibly likable guy. He was in a position in the Obama administration when the Russia information came up.
He's scary looking.
He's big. So he can look as if he's the perfect exemplar of the deep state that Trump can bat with and beat. And sometimes Mr. Brennan, sort of hyperbole as he talks back, plays right into Mr. Trump's sort of political gamesmanship. So I think Mr. Brennan is the thing. I agree with the things he's saying, but he's become sort of a very useful tool, I think, for the Trump people, more so than probably Mr. Hayden, who never worked for the Obama administration and others.
Currently a really just interesting question. How is John Brennan understood within the CIA? He had a long career within it. He ran it. He was also rare for a CIA person in the White House in a kind of oversight capacity with respect to the agency. You know, is he understood as somebody who, when he says things, it's understood to have the political valence that the president is attaching to it? Or is he just understood to be, you know, straight shooting former leadership whose views are taken very seriously within the agency?
Yeah, it's a hard, I mean, like in any large organization, there's lots of opinions, and it would be wrong for anybody to say the CIA or CIA officers tend to think this. Mr. Brennan, because he was in the agency and then was at the White House before returning to the agency, did have a bit of a mixed reputation. He was seen as a little bit more political than some other directors we've had. He also very strongly represented that tribe, like I talked about earlier, of analysts as opposed to field clandestine officers. And whether right or wrong, he was seen as trying to promote one tribe above the other and bring one down. So a lot of people who are in my world, he had a sort of a mixed reputation and wasn't really liked. He also did a large sort of reshuffling of the organization, and any major reorganization causes pain and creates tensions between those who support it and those who don't. So I certainly see Mr. Brennan as a very serious person. He's a very thoughtful person. I think he took his job very seriously, and many believe he did a good job, but it's more mixed than some others. If you talk to CIA officers, you know, they tend to like Mr. Panetta, Mr. Tenet, in a certain way, sort of the same thing. He became more political as he moved on and got associated with the Bush White House. So it really depends on who you're talking to, their opinion of Brennan. There's a lot of people who really just don't like him and are angry about what he's doing, and there are a lot of people who respect him deeply.
So who are, you mentioned Panetta and Tenet, who are the leaders among the people who are speaking publicly who you can really say, the fact that so-and-so is speaking represents a deep current of thinking within the workforce rather than just so-and-so who's a former leader or deputy director speaks, you know, kind of has an opinion on the subject?
Well, at least as far as I'm concerned, when I hear John McLaughlin speak or when I hear General Michael Hayden speak, I'm always impressed with their thoughtfulness, and I tend to take it almost more seriously than when I hear the other ones. I think, you know, Mike Morrell is very thoughtful. I think a lot of the other leaders are doing important work. But those two, to me, seem to be the most sensible, apolitical representatives of the intelligence community that I think of, at least off the top of my head.
I want to return to the subject of the New York Times story and just conclude by asking you, to the extent that you could toggle things in domestic politics in order to make it less likely that you're going to have negative effects in field operations, the equivalent, say, of reducing carbon emissions, right? It's not going to prevent every hurricane, but it may reduce the average likelihood of weather events that are more extreme than, right? So what is the equivalent of reduced carbon emissions in this area? What are the things you could change that improve the environment for intelligence collection?
Well, obviously the main one is the crazy stuff the president says. We're in a different world. It's going to be hard to figure out the damage over time on so many levels, on military and diplomatic, but also on the intelligence side. But the one that's sort of really surprising and needs to be put back in is our professional congressional oversight committees were always seen as, if not nonpartisan, at least bipartisan, and they took that job seriously. The fact that the House committee has become essentially just a shill to support the president and therefore willing to attack institutions, you know, sort of almost blatantly for partisan reasons, that's a real problem because, you know, that oversight we take very seriously. We take it very seriously, and I say we, when I was in the CIA, of providing them the information they need to do that job well. And if we get to a point where the intelligence agencies, whether it's NSA or CIA or any others, are nervous about providing secrets to our oversight committees, or they do to one committee and not the other, that's sort of a dangerous place to be. The stuff with the president, you know, that's the sort of thing that just shreds trust over time. And one of the things we haven't talked about here, when we talk about intelligence collection and information that comes to the United States through the NSA, through CIA, one of the key things and probably one of the most important things is our trusting relationships with allies and some semi-allies overseas. A good chunk of the intelligence that this country gets, we get by working with those allies overseas on terrorist cases, on Russia issues, on China issues. If those places are worried that their intelligence might get politicized or might get publicized, they're going to raise the bar about what they share with the United States. So if I'm the head of the British SIS, their version of intelligence service, I'm really going to think twice about providing the most sensitive information to the United States. Or I might think about, should I share it with the FBI as opposed to the CIA and those type of things. And once we're into that game, that's unhelpful for the United States as a whole.
John Cypher, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It's fun.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to John Cypher for coming into the Jungle Studio to chat with me about this issue. Our audio engineer this week is Matthew Kahn. We are edited and produced by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And we still need you to promote the Lawfare Podcast. So leave us a review, tweet us, share us on Facebook, and talk about us incessantly at dinner parties. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.